little bit of LCD sound system right here on the Event Horizon. That track was Movement from their eponymously titled album, LCD Sound System, from a couple years back. There's actually his. It's just one guy who does everything, sings and plays all the instruments, and then gets other people to tour around with him. Before that, we heard a little clip. It's actually not from the Beastie Boys. It just happened to be one on one of their old CD singles. And start out with a little Sex with Rattler Ben. And let's go back just a year or two. A little bit of... Oh, that sounds bad, bad, bad. A little bit of Chibo Matu doing Blue Train.
That's the way the stomach rumbles. That's the way the bee bumbles. That's the way the needle pricks. That's the way the glue sticks. That's the way the potato mashes. That's the way the pan flashes. That's the way the market crashes. That's the way the whip lashes. That's the way the teeth gnashes. That's the way the gravy stains. That's the way the moon wanes.
Thank you. I ain't gonna take it no more. I ain't gonna take it no more. I ain't gonna stand idly by while the bridal reply of a marriage of styles is, yeah, but what's their demographic? I ain't gonna take it no more. I ain't gonna take it no more. I ain't gonna stand idly by with a tut and a sigh while inside we all cry out for something new. I ain't gonna take it no more. I ain't gonna take it no more. Soulless music, artless lyrics, goalless movements, heartless gimmicks, controlled and clueless, careers last in a minute. If this is the big life, well, I ain't looking to live it. We ain't pushing the boundaries, we're blowing them up. We ain't trying to expand the scene, we want the scene to erupt. So make some room on the floor and somebody bolt the doors, because tonight, we ain't seeking applause. Tonight, well, gee. Just want to have some good new fashion fun, y'all.
Fashion fun is coming your way. That may be stretching it, but it's Bathrobe Spears Broadsides coming up next. It's the October 9th, 2014 show, so stay tuned and you'll be able to hear what you'll hear.
The hallway, a problem for only one reason. That president raises the question, who owns a plan? The homeless, our problem. For only one reason, our president raises a question, who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Could it be 90 million dead in the end? Who owns the land? Could it be 6 million Jews? Who owns the land? Is there a rushes, raises a question, who owns a land? Ecocide, genocide, where is hope? Ecocide, genocide, where is hope? Ecocide, genocide, where is hope? Ecocide, genocide, where is
home? And home is nowhere for folks who are on the streets, or, as they say, everywhere is home, or the earth is home, or, well, do they get treated with hospitality, hostilipitality, as I said yesterday to a couple of performers who are given the latest rules by the hosts and the First Alarm Security on Pacific Avenue. Welcome to Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides. You're listening to the stream of Free Radio Santa Cruz, freakradio.org. This is a two-hour show, Thursdays, 3.5 hours on Sundays, where I babble at you. You hopefully occasionally react by calling in and giving your thoughts. Also play some interviews from the past few weeks. And read from clippings and such. Maybe occasionally play a little audio. It's all about homeless civil rights for poor people and where the might someday, somewhere be found, and how it is best to try to hold, do holding actions, actually is the right way to put it, as they are snatched away, eroded away, washed away, gradually snuck away. Tonight there is a city council candidate forum at the Calvary Episcopal Church. That's the red church on Lincoln and Cedar Streets. It's not in the usual place where people go to eat meals in the dining area. It's in the kind of the chapel, I guess it is, the services area. And it begins at 7. I believe it goes to 8:30 or 9. I'm going to try to record it by having somebody there with one of my trusty, much-arrested little tape recorders. But we'll see how that works. I'm not terribly optimistic about hearing anything even worth repeating at these candidate forums, but you can always be surprised, and it's, I suppose, it's a good thing to let the candidates know that they're being listened to by a few who are keeping a watch on their their claims, their objectives, just how far they're willing to waver, sway, and wander off to the right, which seems to be the big deal, the major proclivity these days. So again, Calvary Episcopal Church, if you want to check out the candidate forum, should be starting in about 45 minutes. It's described as a forum by the Association of Faith Communities, and it is on compassionate governance and social justice. This is, of course, the same association which contains churches that have recently cut back their programs. And, of course, the Red Church itself, which notoriously decided to run homeless people off the lawn between 5 and 6 during the Monday homeless meal. They claim there have been some smoking problems or some behavior problems. But didn't explain why they had to run everybody off the lawn, which, of course, forces people to fill up the sidewalks. You're going to hear some discussion of that in some of the audio I'm playing tonight, some of the tapes, because it is audio via tapes. Some more details about this forum, though, for those who are interested. This is our format, they say, will be a panel of three local leaders, each deliver short remarks about a particular subject, and then pose one question to the candidates in a rotating fashion. The forum duration will be 90 minutes. They've asked Pastor Steve DeFields Gambrell and Linda LeMaster to serve as panelists, and the third panelist will be a former city council member to be announced when confirmed. Steve will be talking about the need for more and better social and mental health resources, and his questions will address that area. Linda will be doing the same on housing and homelessness. Former mayor and Santa Cruz City Councilmember Celia Scott will comment on the part compassionate government plays in public service, and her questions will address how candidates view their role as a council member from a compassionate perspective. I'm always a little wary about this compassion stuff. I'm more concerned with justice, and that's something that homeless people and everybody in this community actually sorely needs. I mean, income equality has been, a growing, a festering sore for a long time. It's not even a festering sore. It's an all-consuming cancer, really. the fact that a few have a lot and the rest have a little and everybody else gets to work for the few and that sort of thing. And they claim to get people who have the opportunity to ask, an invaluable opportunity to ask questions about social issues. Yeah, that might be good. It doesn't indicate whether people can actually stand up and ask a question or whether they're going to play the little, will you write it on a 3x5 card and we'll decide which of these questions we want to be asked. That's what's been the practice at other candidate forums, and it's generally a way of sorting out the meat, the wheat from the chaff, and you can be sure it's usually the chaff that remains, or at least, you know, I haven't paid too much strict attention this season, so I want to be honest, but that's been the kind of experience I've had, or at least it's my kind of recollection when I look back on past candidate forums. But maybe it'll be a good one. Check it out, 7 o'clock at the Red Church. The Assembly Hall, I guess it's called. Tomorrow there's an event for World Homelessness Day. I may have mentioned this before. Linda LeMaster, one of the panelists, is throwing this event herself along with, I guess, a couple of other folks who are kind of opening things up to a discussion of homelessness at the IHOP, the International House of Pancakes, in Capitola on 41st and Capitola Road. It's a little further down 41st if you take a right off Capitola Road heading out of town. It's going to go from 2 to 4 tomorrow, in case anyone's interested. You can check that out. There's a little discussion of it, or a little notice about it, posted on Santa Cruz Indie Media, indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, a website that I often post on, and you'll find it, I hope, online, if you just go check it out. I'm looking at it right now. Celebrate World Homeless Action Day, conversation about being homeless, 2 to 4. To appreciate people who have been dealing with homelessness, sponsored by Smart Solutions to Homelessness, which I'm no fan of, Lived Experience Group. It's a mid-county, 41st Avenue near Capitola. It's going to be a facilitated circle-style conversation with co-chairs Janice Kern and Linda LeMaster. And I think coffee and maybe pancakes will be available, but the main deal is not the food, it's the conversation. They're bringing brief info on the strategic plan to end homelessness. Oh, God, not make me puke. Santa Cruz County strategic plan. I'm really tired of these strategic plans that the government delights on spending so much money on, but has nothing to do with actually setting up real emergency either shelter, housing, or campground facilities. Western Regional Advocacy Project's Homeless Bill of Rights. I've heard there's a new one out. I got a call, actually, this evening from Sacramento homeless activist Paula, and she's going to send me the latest updated version of the State Homeless Bill of Rights being proposed in Sacramento. The last one kind of died quietly in committee, or perhaps noisily in committee, last year. Santa Cruz County's affordable housing plan changes brewing, according to the folks at the World Homelessness Day action tomorrow, or discussion tomorrow at the International House of Pancakes, and the Smart Solutions to Homelessness. Smart Solutions. The Allies campaign. And check it out. Go online. And 2 to 4, IHOP. You're welcome. If you can afford to pay for yourself, that's better. If you can't, I think that there's some people willing to stand you for whatever they're doing there. And if you can't eat, at least you can talk. I think that's the understanding. And people with backpacks will presumably be allowed. If not, Huff will probably show up next week and be marching up and down with picket signs, or we should be anyway. So that's a couple of events that are happening. I think there's also there's more. I actually created a list of these suckers. Let's see if I can actually find it here. Well, take a peek. There's a Sanctuary Village potluck tomorrow night. That's Brent Adams' project to create a small model a homeless encampment that is well run, pleasing to the community, and so far completely cold-shouldered by city council and other authorities. But if you're interested in that, that's at 535 Spring Street, 7 to 10 p.m., and that's at the Jungle House. Then on Sunday, on October 12th, from 9:30 to 11, on this show, Craig Bush, I'm pretty sure, will be showing up, and I will be meeting him on time, and so we will be getting together, and hopefully you will be able to have some of your questions answered. Craig Bush is, I think, no relation to the infamous Bush family. He's a tall guy with a long white beard, as I remember from what I've seen at one of the forums. And you can read more about him at indiebay.org/Santa Cruz or at his own website. That's, if you browse for Craig Bush, city council candidate, you'll probably find it. But you can also find it at Santa Cruz Indie Media. He is running for one of the three vacancies in the Santa Cruz City Council. And who knows, he may be at the forum tonight. You may be able to see him there. Voting, of course, has already begun, I believe. It's so people can now vote absentee, and so the election really is ongoing for the next month. His platform is available at Bush for SC Council, if you want to go there. And I've already kind of read a summary of his stuff in past shows, but he is a supporter of ending the harassment and persecution of the Santa Cruz 11. He's angry about it. He doesn't like the attack on homeless people happening in Santa Cruz, if I understand properly his stuff. He doesn't like the registering of indigents out at the Santa Cruz Homeless Lack of Services Center. And he has a sort of his main focus is not on homeless on civil rights issues. His main focus has to do with water issues, the boondoggle of DSAL, and other sort of more innovative schemes for addressing economic problems, which he will no doubt be discussing, although I'll probably be nudging him over to my side of the map where I actually have some knowledge and interest in what's going on, which is civil rights issues in Santa Cruz. And as ever, so this is going to be I'll be interested more in what he's going to be doing, what he's doing now, what he does the day after the election, and what he's going to do if he's ha-ha-ho-ho elected. He's the least funded of all the candidates, and he's got about as much chance of getting elected as Steve Plaich did in the last two elections, or I did in 2006 when I ran as a write-in candidate. It ain't going to happen. But more important are the issues he raises and what kind of mobilization of the community can be done outside this process. That's always been something I've been encouraging people to consider. So that's going to be 9:30 to 11 on Sunday, and my next show, which actually runs until 1, so we'll be discussing other stuff as well. So you check that out and see what you think. You can also email in questions at rnorse3@hotmail.com, R-N-O-R-S-E-3, that's my name, Robert Norris, rnorris3@hotmail.com. That afternoon, there's going to be a Friendship Garden shindig run by Jim Weller, who's a member of the faith communities, who sort of, I think he was kind of outspoken in behalf of homeless civil rights at one point. He's going to have Lainey Sherman there, one of the council candidates. This happens at And it's going to be happening in Harvey West Park, 4:30 to 5:30, again, next Sunday. It's called the Matthew Coalition, and they're going to meet with the three candidates and talk to them. I guess it's another sort of religious group. It looks like some religious groups are getting more active around issues as homeless people get more harassed, and good for them. There is a candidate forum coming up. I'm not sure how many candidates are going to be actually going to it. That's going to be October 21st. Which is, looks like it's a Tuesday after next. And it's going to be at Loudoun Nelson Center from 7 to 9. That's run by tenant advocates. And this may be the most significant forum of all the forums because it's all very well to blather on about compassion and, you know, having a big heart. And everybody likes to talk about this, but when we want to talk about specific problems around renter protection and a lack of renter protection, you have to get into some detail and you have to come down on some positions. And again, that's going to be Tuesday the 21st, 7 to 9, Loudoun Nelson Center. If in fact the 21st is Tuesday, as I think it is. And then on the 22nd, on Wednesday, is National Day of Protest Against Police Brutality. And HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, yesterday decided it would take up some issues on the day of protest against police brutality to be concerned about local issues of police abuse. You may remember in the past I've talked about the failure of the police department to give any public response to Officer Vasquez is smashing Richard Hardy face down onto the sidewalk or letting him fall when he was drunk in handcuffs, an event captured by Brent Adams on video about a year and a half ago. Also, there's the issue of Jasmine and her mother being confronted by Officer Azua at the Thanksgiving meal on the 26th of November, 2 days before Thanksgiving, actually, at the Salvation Army meal up on Laurel Street, and actually having a gun drawn on them, and then being harassed later and mocked by the same officer, Azua. Again, without any kinds of response. And because of the ongoing rising protests against police killings elsewhere in the country, including as nearby as Salinas, where the police chief, who doesn't mind giving learned commentary at the bookshop Santa Cruz, or the bookshop Coonerty, as I call it, but couldn't seem to get it together to release the names of the four officers who had shot four different people in Salinas. I think they eventually did. There are real local concerns about these issues that I have. They're more in the nature of how people are treated, roughed up, summarily separated from their rights, as in terms of the right to be in public places, particularly if you're a poor, homeless person or appear to be homeless. And, of course, the most obvious and long-going grievance that I've spoken about so many times, the right to sleep peacefully, not anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere. And that means not necessarily inside a concentration camp prison setting either. But it certainly means not to be arrested if there's no places to sleep that one can go to sleep in. And that is something that the city continues to do and also continues to avoid responsibility for. I still have not received back from the police department any list of the people whose sleep crimes have been forwarded to the courts. Although the city attorney's office and the police department have such lists, they have to. Or at least they have the lists of the people that whose tickets they have dismissed because they were required to do so by a law that states if you are on the city's, actually it's a private organization, the Homeless Lack of Services Center's Paul Lee Loft waiting list, or the waiting list for the River Street shelter, the mini shelter as I call it, then you are not only are your tickets dismissed, but you are not even subject to the sleeping ban. Officers should not even be approaching you to give you a citation. But the authorities and the people running these shelter services have been so apprehensive of the police and so cowardly on these issues that they have declined to issue regular receipts or evidence of the fact that a person is on the waiting list, so that a person who, because you're on the waiting list, you can't be in the shelter, you got to be outside, can show it to a police officer when they do their usual or their occasional. It's occasional in the sense that not everybody is woken up every night, but large numbers of people are woken up, and significant numbers of people receive $157 citations, I think it is. It seems to be steadily rising, even though the code book says it's supposed to be $20. And so it's $20 with all these other court fees and fines added on, which mean, and the way you can tell what an actual cost of a sleeping ticket is, a ticket under municipal code 6.36010A or B or C. A is actually the sleeping ban. B is the blanket ban. C is the camping ban. Is you just go to the court window and ask what the bail is. How much do you have to pay to avoid going to court? And last I heard, I think it was $157. That was months ago. So it may have risen. I've never heard of it dropping, except when activists went to city council 14 years ago and agitated to, they were trying to get the sleeping ban eliminated, or at least eliminated in some parts of the city, and they were sold out by the so-called liberals who had been elected and refused to do that. But they did throw the homeless and their activists a bone by reducing the penalties to no more than 8 hours of community service or $20 fine until, of course, the court fees are added, which, of course, made it first $50-some dollars, then $90-some dollars, and now $157-some dollars. Well, that's a half an hour wrap to begin the show with. I thought I was going to actually get a little further, but I'm always surprised. This is National Mental Health Week, by the way, which I don't usually have much to say about. Although it is true that I've heard, and I haven't spoken yet to her, but Sarah Leonard, Steve Plaich, and attorney Judy Berry are working on a lawsuit to restore the rights of homeless people whose property are being seized by police and Parks and Rec rangers. And I don't know where that's going, because Steve Plaich is being hyper-secretive about it. But I have seen Judy Berry out there at the Red Church a couple weeks ago getting people's accounts, and I'm hoping that it's going further. So that's good. As for mental health generally, I've been concerned about the arrival of Laura's Law in Santa Cruz, but that hasn't happened yet as far as I know, and I haven't gotten any indication that it is, but I am not really with my fingers on the pulse of the mental illness industry, so to speak. The psychiatric honchos who will essentially decide if they want to bring in Laura's Law. Laura's Law is a much loosened standard for committing people, and as I call it, needles on wheels, because what it means is that people can be forced to take dangerous and actually psychosis-producing medication that are supposed to stop psychotic behaviors. In some cases, they can be helpful, I suppose. That's the claim of the patients and certainly the psychiatric profession, some of the patients. In others, and in the majority of cases, it seems that that's not the case, according to experts like Robert Whitaker, who have studied the research that the psychiatric industry continues to ignore. But in any case, Laura's Law is a response to, I don't know, some one freak incident where, I don't know, actually, it's sort of similar, I think, to Kendra's Law in New York, but the law itself talks about changing the standard for incarcerating someone against their will from, you got to be clear and present danger, that's not the right word, danger to yourself, danger to others, or gravely disabled. So that is the standard under the earlier for the last 30 or 40 years, although that's still apparently big enough for some people to get hauled into court anyway on what's called 5150s, which is 72-hour holds. But there's an even bigger memory hole into which you can be dropped under Laura's Law, and that's been passed by San Francisco. I think it's passed by Nevada County and a section of L.A. County. They have some trial program in the jails that are using it. But it's an expensive program because it has required until last year that all kinds of other standards be met in terms of providing options to people who are classified as mentally ill and given a diagnosis of one sort or another. But anyway, it's National Mental Health Week from October 5th through the 11th. So I guess it's almost over. So that was something I brought up because a member of our group wanted it to mentioned, and I thought I should mention it, and so I did. I think I'm going to turn now to some interviews just so that I can listen to something other than my own voice and take a breather, and invite you to call in. The call-in number here is 831-427-3772. Again, 427-3772. This is freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norris. The name of the show is Bathrobes, Pierre's Broadsides. We are streaming, and we are looking for a place to put up an antenna so that we can start broadcasting again. It's possible we may have a temporary spot, which is perilous, and it doesn't really suit us for any long term, but is something we may be able to use briefly. But we're still looking for your help. Contact freakradio.org if you know of anybody with a large tree on their property or a second story. The antenna is not that high, and it doesn't, I guess, 57 feet or something, or 47 feet, something to that effect. And I encourage people to also call my number, 423-4833, if you want to talk to me about any suggestions you may have. So far, I haven't gotten one call on this issue, so I don't hear a lot of people interested in this. And I've got to tell you that this may mean, as I've often said, sort of the quiet conclusion of Free Radio Santa Cruz, because a number of the broadcasters do not want to put out energy to come into the studio if they are simply talking over the Internet. They can do that at home. And which may mean, you know, that these things evolve. So it isn't necessarily a bad thing. But if you like Free Radio Santa Cruz, then you need to help us out. And give us some suggestions. Ask your friends if they have a place where an antenna could be put up. Keep your eyes open. And let us know. 423-4833. So, let's hear some interviews.
It is October 4th, 2014. I'm here talking with
Colin Campbell-Clyde.
And Colin, you've used different facilities that unhoused folks used, MH10 and also the homeless, what I call it, lack.
Let's see if we can improve the quality of that.
Services center, although they do provide some services, though not shelter really. And you had a critical comment about their sort of new regime or new equipment there.
Well, I went to Homeless Persons Health Project to get some medical services. So to their credit, I, you know, was able to get some help with some respiration problems I've been having. They have this new security fence now. It's like a steel fence, and it's got this crazy door. It looks like an airlock or something, you know, with like shatterproof glass sort of booth. Kind of a build.
Contamination chamber.
Right, yeah, hazmat suits and all that. And I just thought the whole thing was ridiculous. I mean, it definitely, in terms of the psychological effect, definitely makes the whole place seem a lot more like a prison. And then, you know, if my understanding of the rationale is that, the businesses in that area are being impacted by all these homeless people hanging out, and I don't really see how, I mean, putting up a fence, I guess they can reduce the amount of people going in and out of the facility, but there's still going to be people hanging out up the street there, whether it's a fence or not. I just think it's a security theater sort of thing. Like, it doesn't actually solve the problem, but it creates the appearance of solving the problem, and it creates the appearance of we're getting really tough and cracking down. And, you know, that plays well.
For an imperialist, appearance is everything, no?
Well, I suppose so. I mean, I just think it would be more reasonable and practical to actually seek a solution for the problem as opposed to creating You know, I don't really see what the point of it is besides to kind of intimidate people.
Well, as a devil's advocate here, the problem with Santa Cruz, as some have said, is it is far too welcoming to individuals who are drug users, loiterers, layabouts, folks who also maybe have severe disabilities that, you know, are lured to Santa Cruz with the idea of easy life, easy drugs, easy camping, nice beaches and so forth, nice weather. And this homeless lack of services center, or homeless services center as they call it, is a way of accommodating and encouraging this. So if you make it a little more difficult and a little more structured and a little more confined, you're going to find a smaller group of people using that center, because you won't be able, for example, sex offenders, you know, individuals who are caught wee-weeing on the street at different times, as well as those who are actual molesters or convicted of that, are not even allowed in there. And others may feel reluctant to expose their citations, even if the citations are somewhat trivial, because trivial citations can turn into more serious citations. So that would be my answer, that you are in fact making it clear that Santa Cruz is not a place for those without a steady job and money and connections of an indoor sort to come.
Well, that pretty much harkens back to what I was just saying before, which is this idea of security theater. You know, it's like the TSA, the Transportation Security Agency, feeling your crotch isn't making you safer from terrorism, but it sure puts on a big show, and you know, and has an intended psychological effect. So, you know, when you read people who are actually in the security industry and study how these things work, I mean, that's one thing that they warn against is having real effective security versus, you know, putting on a big production number to look like we have security, which isn't the same thing as actually being secure.
But wouldn't you agree that cutting down the number of people who have access to this facility, in fact, results in smaller crowds in the area, though some would say people are crowding outside in the low or no impact zones, although that is also being discouraged, the sidewalk area around the homeless lack of services center, by security guards, by, I guess there's sort of, I've never gotten clear statements about whether people are penalized for hanging around outside in terms of denial of services, but I'm wondering if that isn't the case. And then finally, these no parking signs that are up all over the place. Doesn't this in fact reduce the number of folks and therefore, some might say, increase the security?
Well, if you make it harder to get into the homeless shelter, then obviously there's going to be more people outside of the homeless shelter. You know, reducing the amount of services, setting up barriers to services so it'll seem less welcoming, I mean, that doesn't change the underlying economic reality that some people are poor, and that's just the world we live in.
What about the needles? What about the needles?
Oh, the needles. That's such a fear-mongering, you know, selected that
6,500 needles in the last 2.5 years, according to Take Back Santa Cruz, a headline story in the Santa Cruz Sentinel.
Yeah, and what was their methodology for coming up with that? I mean, I don't, you know, I'd like to see...
I could show you their stats, actually, on this computer, but in fact, my general argument to that is it may be true that there were 6,500 needles diligently sought out in refuse heaps and other places by the clean team, and by, I guess it's the needle discovery, needle search team, whatever they call themselves. And, you know, that's a service to get rid of, you know, discarded needles. They're a hazard, just like broken glass or any other sharp objects are. Probably not much more of a hazard, even though they seem to be, you know, we're all afraid of needles ever since we're kids, most of us. But, in fact, the number of needles actually exchanged, or safely disposed of, each year is around 400,000. 200,000 through the needle exchange directly, and then 200,000 through the different needle exchange, the two disposal units, one of them in Watsonville, one in Santa Cruz. This is what I was told. And again, would like a verification one way or another, but that's my understanding. So 6,500 compared to 400,000 is a relatively small number of needles to be found. Although, I have to say...
It makes for a nice scare headline, though. And, here's the ultimate thing, is that... I walk around town a lot because I don't own a car, and so, I do a lot of my traveling on foot or by bus, but quite a bit of it, like, actually, walking the neighborhoods, and I'm not stepping on needles everywhere. I'm not seeing needles all over the place. If you go out of your way to invade a camp where you know that people who are heroin addicts or crystal meth addicts are camping there, then lo and behold, you're going to find needles in those camps. But this idea that has been spread around town because it furthers people's political agendas that, oh, there's just needle. You can't step outside your front door without pricking your foot on a needle. That's just not the case. There aren't needles all over the place. Like, it's been exaggerated, and they selected that issue in the first place because most people don't like getting stuck with the needle. If you ever have to do that, you go into the doctor, it's not my favorite thing. So it gives people kind of an icky feeling, it's a very visceral kind of sensation.
How long have you lived here?
How long have I lived in Santa Cruz? I've lived here for more than a decade.
And how many needles have you run across?
Oh, yeah, every now and then I'll see one, or I'll see, like, the top of a sharps, a plastic piece from the needle, but not the whole needle itself. Very rare.
How many would you say?
In total, that's hard to even estimate because we're talking over...
One a year, one a month?
Closer to one a year.
Because I've seen one needle in my experience in Santa Cruz, and I've lived here. But again, maybe I'm just not... I do have a car, and I have been spending a lot of time away from Santa Cruz.
I've been pretty much in Santa Cruz for 24 years, or actually 26 years, and then periodically in and out of Santa Cruz for another... 13 years before that.
So I come down there almost every day, but I do travel around certain limited areas. So I'll show you the statistics that the Take Back Santa Cruz affiliated group that was the subject of a Sentinel story, what they show us.
Before you do that, I just wanted to say that, another thing, this idea that, there's all these homeless people here because Santa Cruz is too inviting to homeless people. There's homeless people all over the place. There's homeless people all over the country. So it's not like every single town where there's homeless people is being too inviting. It's an economic reality that there's just not enough jobs to go around for people.
Well, there are those who will claim, and perhaps with some justification, that the percentages of homeless people in Santa Cruz are significantly more than, let's say, in numerous other cities in California.
It might be the case that, a certain number of people come here because it's a beach town. You're not going to change the fact that it's a beach town, okay? So let's say that you have, like, a incoming flow of people on a regular basis because it's a beach town. Everybody wants to enjoy it. Some of those people happen to be affluent tourists. Throw out the red carpet for them, put out the welcome mat. A certain percentage of those people are going to be not affluent. So are we saying that people who are not affluent don't have a right to come to Santa Cruz? I mean, that seems like that's the conclusion that gets drawn with that argument. I think even if it's, a disproportionate amount, it's still... That disproportionate difference is a little blip, and essentially what's important to note is that there's homeless people all over the United States, and certain towns maybe more than others. Certain towns maybe tend to attract people from other places more than others, but you know, I think that focusing on that is really losing sight of, you know, the overall picture, which is that, you know, poverty is on the rise in general in the United States.
And we've been talking with
Colin Campbell Clyde.
Thanks, Colin.
And that was earlier this week, ran into Colin, actually last week, a week ago, more or less. I was also in correspondence with Julie Hendy. I didn't realize that this was the person I'd be in correspondence with. She's a person, was with the redevelopment agency, and now she's with the group that is putting together the cages for the allowed performance and vending and tabling space on Pacific Avenue. And perhaps elsewhere in the city, although I think it's Pacific Avenue. You may remember a year ago, the city essentially removed all but less than 1% of Pacific Avenue as available legal vending, tabling, or performing space. Actually, also for sitting and peaceful spare changing space as well. And I actually went up and down the avenue measuring what was left. And if you consider the entire avenue, let's say before the merchant and sidewalk cafes took their slice of the pie, and consider that as that's the 100% of the avenue, and then you look at, subtract all the areas where the sidewalk cafes are, subtract all the areas where you are within 14 feet of a building, 14 feet of a crosswalk, 14 feet of a bench, 14 feet of a trash can, 14 feet of a kiosk, 14 feet of a directory sign, 14 feet of a so-called sculpture, which arguably includes these large, obscene, red, don't be generous, don't give money to panhandler meters that are occasionally pop up like black mushrooms, actually red mushrooms on Pacific Avenue. You have less than 1% of the space available for essentially poor people, or just older residents who want to stop and who haven't got the money for sidewalk cafes. And I suppose there's also bench space. Half of the benches that were put in after the earthquake have been removed, again, at the behest of private businesses without any kind of public process. And you have a very small amount of space left. You also have outrageous requirements for people to set up a table. I saw these requirements being enforced yesterday when I was having a bite to eat at Betty's Burgers, carnivore that I am. I saw the decorum police out there. It was the first alarm security, the cheap cops, you know, that they use, kind of huddling with the hosts, the yellow jackets, and going after artists who if their table is more than 12 square feet, which is very small. There's actually three squares on Pacific Avenue is 12 square feet. It's not enough to set up a really to do a two-player guitar affair. In any case, I wanted to find out. Well, what happened was I was wandering down Pacific Avenue. I think it was after the last city council meeting, and I found some dots that were kind of put into a, well, they marked out a rectangular areas along Pacific Avenue, small rectangular areas of usually 24 square feet, so a total of 4 by 6 feet on the side. And I wanted to find out what was going on, so I sent an email to Scott Collins, who seems to always has his up to his neck in this kind of dirty business. He's the assistant to the assistant city manager. And I said, Scott, folks have drawn to my attention the colored dots on Pacific Avenue, various spots. They've suggested the dots enclosing rectangular areas may indicate a proposed set of non-forbidden zones for performers, vendors, tablers. What's up and what do the different colors mean? Thanks. And I wrote him this on Wednesday, actually. Gosh, I guess it was yesterday. Wow. And in a very short amount of time, actually, on the same day, I got a response from Julie Hendy, who in my book is notorious for her her successful move to transfer money from the police department's budget to the city. Well, I'm not sure what department did it, but they moved the little gated fence around the large planter in front of Rosie McCann's forward so that you couldn't sit down on the planter anymore. It's illegal if you try to sit on the railing. Sitting on the beams of the cement around trees on Pacific Avenue, even though you probably can't hurt the cement with your butt, is a couple $100 crime. And I don't know if they've been enforcing that one much lately, but I wouldn't be surprised. In any case, Handy got the police department to kick down $6,000, or she oversaw that project, to essentially was going after musician Cosmic Chris, who the owners of the Pacific Trading Company didn't like. They didn't want him playing outside their area, and they felt that people who could sit on that one of the few sittable waist-high planters. There were several of them. One of them is the one that's in front of New Leaf Market, and that is now privatized. One of them is near Jamba Juice, and you can still sit on that planter area. And then there's this one in front of, and there's another one in front of the Verizon area, or near Verizon. It's not quite in front of it. And there's still room to sit on that planter. I think there's also another one near the Bookshop Santa Cruz, where it's illegal to sit, but you are not allowed to play with a display device by sitting on that property. Again, the attempt to make it such spaces few and far between and then move people along every hour is a very real attack on street performers and vendors and so forth. So, anyway, Julie Handy wrote me back. She was the person who has been involved in some of these what I call anti-homeless architectural shifts, changes, rules. She wrote, "Good afternoon, Mr. Norris. The spots on the sidewalk are designating spaces for performance, tabling, and vending. Blue represents performance, tabling, and vending. Red represents tabling and vending only. And yellow represents performance only. Please be aware that the marking process has not been completed, and some spots may be larger than marked." And so I said, oh, interesting. Let's research this a little further. So I sent her another email, and I asked her, and you could do this too. You don't have to wait for me to do it. Thanks, Julie. What's the process for public input into these choices? And Julie responded, that would be at the council meeting. We are aiming for October 28th. And I responded, have you had any public process subsequent to the last council meeting and prior to the next one? Thanks, by the way, for the prompt response. In other words, has there been any input before you started putting dots on the sidewalk? Sort of in plain language. I didn't say it that way, though. And her response was, as I said in my previous email, the time for public input will be at the 10/28 council meeting. That is the first reading of the amended ordinance. And I sent her another email this morning. I understand that your finished product will appear for city council approval at the October 28th council meeting, or at least they're shooting for that. But simply to clarify, since it was authorized by city council, you and others working on this issue have not solicited or accepted public input. Is that correct? And she hasn't yet responded to this, but she may. Although she has been pretty quick in her responses, maybe she is taking the day off, or it seems like she didn't really want to answer that question, which would be to admit, no, we haven't let, you know, we have had no public hearings whatsoever on this. We're just going to present, you know, the fait accompli, the finished deal, so that it can get rubber stamped by the city council in traditional fashion, which is what the Robinson Council and the Bryant Council before it, and then the actually prior councils too do. They essentially do a lot of do actually, but that's not the story. So anyway, if you're interested, you might want to wander down the avenue and look over these spots that they have set up. Very few. Well, then I haven't really done an extensive search. Blue is performance, tabling, and vending. Red is tabling and vending only. And yellow is performance only. So all you guys, make sure you're in the right group and have your papers clear and don't get mixed up. What this actually does, if this is also hooked up to the move-along law, which says you have to move along every hour if you are told to do so after an hour by a cop or a first-alarm security thug, And you have to then move 100 feet away, and you can't come back for 24 hours to that spot. You can't set up a display device in that spot. So what that means is that it's going to further reduce the number of spots, because it means that only some will be allowed for tabling and vending. Others will be allowed for performance, unless they're expanding the number of spaces. You know, maybe they are expanding them slightly, but of course, having contracted them to less than 1%, if they're going to expand them to 2%, I'm frankly not very impressed. The whole notion that people can be moved around by armed guards for actually using open space that is not in anybody's way, to me, is a kind of a fascistic scene, and it encourages people to either rebel and then deal with the consequent risks of that, or to comply, and the kind of humiliation that goes with that, or the sickness of mind that comes with the catering to a fascist mindset is something else that we have to contend with. Let's see what else we got in the way of interviews. So what I did on Monday, as some of you who may read regularly the Santa Cruz Indie Media website or get the Huff email, which you can get by sending an email to me if you want, rnorris3@hotmail.com, rnorris3@hotmail.com, is I attended the Measure K Committee hearing. I've been calling it the Measure K Commission, but apparently it's called the Measure K Committee. This is the group that was set up by the voters to oversee police to make sure that they respected an initiative passed by the voters, although the city council tried to deep six it, which said marijuana enforcement should be the lowest priority in Santa Cruz City for consenting adults in private, on private property, not necessarily in private, but on private property. Over the age of 21 who aren't engaged in any kind of driving activity. And I've talked about this before. Anyway, there was a meeting where Coral Bruhn, who is a commission member and also an occasional Huff activist, I think she may be one of the first people on a city committee. I keep saying commission, but it's a committee, which actually was actually a member of Huff. She was trying to present every half year they're supposed to do a report by to certify that the police department has not gone after people on private property by making marijuana more than the lowest enforcement priority. And the problem is that the police department, well, this commission, this committee, has declined to actually seek from the police department its actual stats and citations to look them over and see if anything requires closer investigation. And they continued to refuse to do this. And Coral said that she actually, I was urging her to vote against the report until such time as she could act. The report was simply a statement from Scott Collins that said, the police department says that they're in compliance. Here's the number of arrests for marijuana, 50-some arrests and citations. Here's the number of calls for service, eight times as many. Actually, there were eight times as many marijuana sites and arrests as there were calls for service for marijuana sites and arrests, which leads one to believe that the police are taking an independent and active and, one should say, proactive, if you will, or toxic approach to going after marijuana that people have not complained about. Now, it's also true that the police will come upon some other incident and they'll see marijuana there, and then they can, you know, add that to the list of charges that D.A. Bob Lee can then throw in people's faces later. That's the same D.A. Bob Lee who is retiring because of cancer, by the way. You know, I felt a certain sympathy at the thought of this. I mean, I may be getting cancer one of these days, so may you if you're over the age of 60, or even if you're not. But then I think of the kind of stress and the kind of abuse that this guy has done with respect to the Santa Cruz 11, of which, admittedly, I am one. And I have to think, good riddance to bad rubbish, to Bob. Much as he's a nice guy, much as I've had friendly conversations with him, much as he's been cooperative in some other respects, his attempt to criminalize the Occupy movement and people who are part of the Occupy movement and activists and terrorize activists in Santa Cruz is, for my mind, it's criminal behavior. It's also, not just, I wanted to call it a massive waste of public resources. I would call it a dangerous use of public money to enforce a right-wing agenda, which has been growing in strength and power over the last few years. In any case, the Measure K Commission met, and I'm going to play a couple of things from it. Coral Bruin stood aside on the vote. Of the annual commission report, or the semi-annual report, actually, which actually the police said, we looked at ourselves and we were very good. We didn't do anything wrong. Kind of reminds me of what Kevin Vogel did in the DIY investigation of the last night spying scandal of 6 or 7 years ago. They sent in a couple of undercover agents to infiltrate the first night ceremonies that Wes Modes and others at that time had organized, and you know, and it's still happening every year in spite of harassment by the police. People come out on the streets and have a ceremony, much less raucous one than that happens later in the evening with booze and, you know, drunken revelry and so forth. Not that that isn't necessarily a bad thing, but you know, it's not my cup of tea. But in any case, Vogel then investigated. There was someone who say, hey, you sent in undercover agents. That's a form of political harassment, doing that to a peaceful event, to a political event. And he investigated himself and then found it was okay. that you can't investigate events yourself if your agency is, and you yourself actually were the person who directed the original item under investigation. So. Same thing is true with the police department's marijuana stuff. That's the reason they're supposed to be independent. Look at this. Anyway, I'll play a little of that after we've heard a little musical aside or two. Assuming we still have the equipment. So we're going to get orchestral here for a bit and play a cut that a little unconventional, but oh well. And that's not quite the cut I was looking for. Ah, I see the problem. Don't go away. I think it had more of an exotic sound and less of an annoying quality on the street when I heard it. And maybe that's where it should be heard, on the street. I'm afraid this is not my cup of tea, actually. Let's hear a little something from the Measure K committee, which is apparently they actually recorded the Measure K committee. Maybe they did that because it's such an irrelevant committee and its conclusion is so such a foregone conclusion, what they're going to come up with, which is nothing, which essentially is agreeing to what the police department says with no independent investigation. They don't have any real outreach, so people don't know there's a commission to complain to if the police have, you know, raid a private space, such as, for example, a homeless vehicle. It's a private space. If the police try to arrest you for smoking marijuana in a homeless vehicle, and I'm not talking about medical marijuana, I'm talking about any marijuana, it's supposed to be the lowest enforcement priority. That doesn't mean you still can't, it can't happen to you, but for them to specifically go around to do so with that intention in mind shows that they don't think it's the lowest priority, because they must obviously have something else to do as well. Since going out to somebody's vehicle takes a certain amount of energy and time. Or somebody calls them up and says, I think someone's smoking marijuana in their vehicle. They have to say, well, we have 16 other calls, rape, assault, problems in a bar, problems at the wharf, you know, that sort of thing. And so, you know, that'll have to wait. That is what they're supposed to do. And if it's on private property and they end up giving people citations, that should be something that this committee is supposed to look into and issue a report criticizing if necessary and suggesting that they're violating the ordinance that was passed by the voters in the city. And that may not do anything. The police department, you know, has its own law, so to speak, has its own rules, its own power structure and so forth. But it has the ability, you know, has the power at least to make the community aware of what's going on. Here's the oral communications period at which I spoke.
So are there any public members that would like to speak for oral communications?
And this is the chair of this is Deborah Elston, who she's the outgoing chair. She's also the co-founder of the Santa Cruz Neighbors, which is the nasty bigot neighborhood group that pushes for much closer police activity in neighborhoods regarding poor and homeless people outside, who helped to elect Lynn Robinson and Pamela Comstock. It's kind of the precursor to Take Back Santa Cruz, the group behind permit parking all over the city at different places where you're not allowed to park unless you have a permit, even though there's no parking actually happening late at night outside a lot of these places. But it's an attempt to mean that homeless people not only can't sleep in their vehicles, they can't even leave their vehicles there while they skulk off to try to find a place to sleep. It's pretty nasty stuff. And Deborah's been involved in that particular organization rather strongly for some time. Guilt by association? No, but I think guilt in the sense that this seems to be what she does. Is she a fan of lowest enforcement priority for marijuana? Well, she at this meeting, she voted in favor of a report where none of the members were able to see the statistics before voting. And none of the members tried to do it. They all said, they told Coral Bruin to go get your own statistics. And she indeed is filing her own Public Records Act request to get those stats. So ironically, it takes citizens or members of the community to do what these titled characters with the little plaques in front of their names who meet regularly and have their little agendas with their name on them. But they won't take the responsibility that goes with the job. Here's some more of this Measure K committee meeting.
Sure. Get 3 minutes out. You ready? You got three minutes?
Depending on how much time.
Three minutes.
Now, you heard Scott Collins suggesting that I only be given 3 minutes. You have to understand that there was nobody else in the room. This is a committee that meets once every 6 months. And this public comment period, the idea of giving a person only 3 minutes to speak, I didn't have a lot to say. But the principle of the thing, just like this business of arresting someone for audio recording at city council meetings, is what bothers me. And what, you know, what makes me kind of stand up and say, no thanks, you know. This process is, if there was a long line of people it might have some justification. Though I think last Tuesday, when there was a long line of people around Paula's cottage affair, that is the incident where they were considering the accessory dwelling unit changes so that accessory dwelling units could be grandfathered in. There could be changes in the law. It was a study session. And the room was full of people who wanted to talk, many of them. And Lynn Robinson shoved a whole bunch of favored speakers, giving them 7 minutes each in front of the mass of people, and then gave everybody 2 minutes, claiming that there was so many people there, instead of extending the meeting, having a second meeting, toughing it out, and or cutting back the time that the experts would be allowed to speak. Again, the attempt to cut back public comment is one that is disturbing.
Well, yeah, I see you have a large crowd here, so it's obvious you need to limit time. I would hope you give the public as much time as they need, unless you have a time problem. That would be my concern usually about this. So, we'll see. I don't know if what I'm going to say takes more than 3 minutes, but I'm always concerned that the public have the time to speak. Some people speak more slowly than others. Some are nervous at the microphone. Some have documents with them that they need to present. And you don't have to make any kind of time limitations unless you choose to want, for some reason, to restrict public comment, which I hope you don't. So, your Measure K Commission was originally created in order to oversee the Santa Cruz Police Agency and make sure that they are making marijuana arrests in private for adults the lowest priority. The commission has not been doing this for the last few years, instead simply relying on summaries from the police department via the city staff, in this case Scott Collins here, which in no way indicates a real examination of the data involved. So while it's quite true, and I'm going to be referring to this when you come up to the actual agenda item, that I'm not suggesting the police department is being inaccurate or in any way misleading in what it's saying, but your job is to oversee it, not to simply rubber stamp statements made by the police department. I'm going to be talking further about the accuracy of the report and what seems to be omitted from the report when you bring that item up shortly, which looks like it's going to be a short meeting. I'm glad that you're keeping a recording of this. Public Safety Committee, for example, does not keep recording for Mike Prescott to change that whole process. Maybe they now are. Yours, even though you only meet twice a year, and it seems like a kind of a pro forma function, is important to those people who use marijuana recreationally in our community. That's a large number of people. They aren't criminals, but they are, in fact, criminalized. And this measure was created in Santa Monica, Santa Barbara here, and in Santa Cruz in order to essentially, it's the first step on a decriminalization measure of marijuana. And you are really entrusted with the responsibility of kind of opening the door to that and making sure that the police department properly spends the funds on real crimes, not phony drug war crimes, or at least phony marijuana crimes. I don't think you can do that unless you have the full data that you're not currently getting from the police department, which you can get by making Public Records Act requests or simply by requesting Scott Collins to proceed.
Thank you.
And are you going to cut me off?
The chair.
Okay, chair.
Give me one more minute. That's it.
I appreciate that, Deborah. And actually, I don't think I'm going to need the minute. I am just encouraging you to do what you've just done, which is to show the community the respect that the city council does not often provide to speakers, even when there's a lot of time available. So thank you very much.
No other people in oral communications, so we'll close oral communications.
You want to note that I arrived late. Pretty
yes,
sure they
had arrived late. She is present, and I am present. Any announcements? No announcements?
I'm not sure. I guess this is the right time. I just when we get to the semi-annual report I had.
And it should be noted that this recording isn't that bad, but the recorder is sitting in the place that it was repeatedly taken away from, and actually I was arrested for replacing it in, which is on the banister between the speaker's podium and the sign-in sheet, where it's been for years. You can actually hear both the speaker and the council members, and you can also, it's positioned so that it's, you know, it's generally audible. Of course, it's also, and doesn't pick up the ambient noise in the rest of the room. Of course, there isn't much noise when the chamber is empty, but in city council meetings, it's often a more crowded situation. So, rather than go on through this rather boring meeting, which essentially had the Measure K committee members shutting down Coral Brune, she wanted there to be the police to look into campers, and she wanted to see if the police were actually going after campers, which is a private space, as I've mentioned before, and seeing, making sure that that was the lowest enforcement priority. She wanted to get copies of the police citations to look at them. She wanted to hear about the amount of money that the police department was spending on these enforcement operations. And this was sort of indignantly rejected by a couple of the committee members. So that's not our job. But in fact, if you look at the Measure K in law, that is their job. At least that is part of the concern of the preamble. And it is mentioned in some of the provisions of the law. It doesn't really require specific twice yearly reports about money spent, but it mentions it as a concern. And it depends, of course, on how concerned the committee is. If you want to read more about this, again, my old favorite, Santa Cruz Indie Media, go there and check out a story I wrote, which is called Measure K Committee Craps Out Again, Another Free Ride for the SCPD. And it's check it out, see if you find anything there of interest. I'm going to change now to shift to something that I kind of ran into a couple days ago. It was an old record, 50 years old actually, called Is Freedom Academic? And it's a documentary put out by radio station KPFA way back around the time of the free speech movement at the University of California in Berkeley. And this is the 50th anniversary of the free speech movement. I'm going to play only a small part of this, and I'll kind of wait to see if anybody likes it, if I hear of any positive feedback. If you like it, leave me a phone message at 423-HUFF, or you can call into the station at 427-3772. Or you can email me at rnorris3@hotmail.com, rnorris3@hotmail.com. The free speech movement involved, well, it's pretty much self-explanatory, though there are also some interesting notes on the record cover, which I may go into as well. And probably those of you who've been following the situation up at Berkeley or were around during those days, or were inspired by it, even if you weren't around during those days, have some notion of what happened. And I'm going to play a bit of this just to give us the historical chill and thrill of going back to those days.
Trying to get something more liberal out of the regions in his telephone conversations, why didn't he make some public statement to that effect? And the answer we received from a well-meaning liberal was the following. He said, would you ever imagine the manager of a firm making a statement publicly in opposition to his board of directors? That's the answer. I ask you to consider, if this is a firm, and if the board of regents are the board of directors, and if President Kerr, in fact, is the manager, and I tell you something, the faculty are a bunch of employees, and we're the raw materials. But we're a bunch of raw materials that don't mean to have any process upon us, don't mean to be made into any product, don't mean to end up
September 2nd, 1964. That was Mario Savio, student and leader of the free speech movement at the University of California at Berkeley. His words preceded a sit-in and strike led by students against the administration of the university, the climax of nearly 3 months of negotiations, protests, and demonstrations. In mid-September, the Dean of Students informed student political organizations that they would no longer be allowed to use the campus to solicit funds or to advocate off-campus political activity. The ban covered organizations ranging from civil rights groups to Students for Goldwater, Young Democrats, Young Republicans, and the Young Socialist Alliance. Most of these groups, about 20 in all, coalesced into a coordinating organization, the Free Speech Movement, or FSM. For 2 weeks, the students negotiated with university officials in an attempt to have the regulation rescinded. Then, on September 30th, some students set out to violate the regulation. Their actions culminated in the demonstrations of October 1st and 2nd, during which students surrounded a police car for more than 30 hours and refused to allow police to remove from the campus and a former student who had joined in violating regulations. At the end of the demonstrations, student representatives and university president Clark Kerr reached agreement that
the student demonstrators shall desist from all forms of their illegal protest against university regulation. Number two, a committee representing students, including leaders of the demonstration, faculty and administration will immediately be set up to conduct discussions and hearings into all aspects of political behavior on campus and its control, and to make recommendations to the administration. Three, the arrested man will be booked but released on his own recognizance, and the university, which is the complainant, will not press charges. This is four. The duration of the suspension of the suspended students will be submitted within 1 week to the Student Conduct Committee of the Academic Senate, not to the administration. Activity may be continued at student organizations in accordance with existing university regulations.
The agreement solved nothing. The day after it was signed, the university announced that there was no such committee as the Committee on Student Conduct of the Academic Senate, and that the cases of the suspended students would be submitted to a committee appointed by the chancellor, the chief administrative officer on the Berkeley campus. Negotiations began again, and demonstrations resumed. On November 20th, the Board of Regents adopted a policy statement under which all of the previously banned activities would be allowed, but the administration would be empowered to take disciplinary action against students who advocated unlawful off-campus activity. The students responded that allowing disciplinary action for advocacy of unlawful activity placed them in double jeopardy, and that the effect of the policy statement was to rule in advance that certain kinds of advocacy were illegal, thus violating the First and 14th Amendments to the United States Constitution. Demonstrations continued. On November 27th, Chancellor Edward Strong sent four students letters which became the catalysts of the demonstrations which ended December 3rd. The chancellor informed the four students that they would be required to attend hearings before the Committee on Student Conduct on charges of illegal activity during the demonstrations of October 1st and 2nd. On December 1st, the Free Speech Movement announced that a round-the-clock sit-in would be held in Sproul Hall, the administration building of the Berkeley campus, if the university did not meet three demands by noon December 2nd. The demands were that charges against the four students be dropped, that the university guarantee to take no further action against students, and that university regulations be revised so that only the courts would regulate the content of political expression, that the faculty, students, and administration would jointly regulate the form of political expression, and that universities unnecessarily restrict repeal. At noon on Wednesday, December 2nd, 4,000 to 5,000 persons attended a rally on the steps of Sproul Hall. The main speaker was Mario Savio.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, by all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Following Savio's speech, Joan Baez spoke, sang, and led a crowd of 1,100 into the building to begin the sit-in.
The only thing that occurred to me, seeing all the people there, I don't know how many of you intend to come inside with us, but that is that you muster up as much love as you possibly can, and as little hatred, and as little violence, and as little angry as you can, although I know it's been exasperating. The more love you can feel, the more chance there is for it to be a success.
Instructions for all the contingencies. Nobody should be standing if the police come to eject us. When the police touch you, we request you to do two things. To ask if you're under arrest and to go limp. And it's very easy to go limp. You just sort of... it's very easy to go limp. It's the easiest thing to do at that time. Now, if you are under arrest, it's going to be very easy. They're going to pick you up and carry you in a paddy wagon. No more instructions are necessary. In terms of that, what goes on down there, going down there, you give me your name and your address, and that's all. But more likely, they'll eject you. When you're carried out of the building and you're sat down, we're asking you not to get up then and trot off home. We're asking you to sit where you're left, or if anything, sit nearer to the door. So I repeat, we don't want any linking arms, we don't want any fighting with the cops, we don't want anybody hurt or any violent incidents.
At 7 p.m., the doors were closed, and police announced that anyone who remained in the building did so in violation of the law of the students. The students showed films. A Hanukkah service was held, ending with a hatikvah. There were classes ranging from a lecture on James Joyce to instruction on civil disobedience.
All right. In other words, what you're saying here, you remember that it is possible that there could be unintentional harm. Okay.
About midnight, most students prepared to go to sleep. At about the same time, Governor Edmund Brown announced, "I have tonight called upon the law enforcement officials in Alameda County to arrest and take into custody all students and others who may be in violation of the law at Sproul Hall. I have directed the California Highway Patrol to lend all necessary assistance. These orders are to be carried out peacefully as a demonstration that the rule of law must be honored in California." The university had not yet issued any statement on the sit-in, But about 1 a.m., the students were awakened with the news that Chancellor Strong was coming with an official statement. He arrived about 3 a.m.
May I have your attention, please? I am Dr. Edward Strong, Chancellor of the Berkeley campus. I have an announcement. This assemblage has developed to such a point that the purpose and work of the university have been materially impaired. It is clear that there have been acts of disobedience and illegality which cannot be tolerated in a responsible educational center and would not be tolerated anywhere in our society. The university has shown great restraint and patience in exercising its legitimate authority in order to allow every opportunity for expressing differing points of view. The university always stands ready to engage in the established and accepted procedures for resolving differences of opinion. I request that each of you cease your participation in this unlawful assembly. I urge you, both individually and collectively, to leave this area. I request that you immediately disperse. Failure to disperse will result in disciplinary action by the university. Please go. Your attention, please. This is Lieutenant M.F. Chandler of the University of California Police Department. A condition of unlawful assemblage now exists under authority of Section 726 of the Penal Code of the State of California, and in the name of the people of the State of California, I command you to disperse. I further notify you that all persons who do not immediately disperse are in violation of the California state law and are subject to arrest. You have 5 minutes to leave the building or you will be arrested.
Although the group inside had dwindled by then to about 800, few, if any, students left the building under the 5 minute time limit. In the next half hour, police reinforcements arrived, and about 3:45, the arrests began.
The elevator is stopped here up on the fourth floor. They're using a Polaroid camera, and the police are taking pictures of each of them. Seems that they're not taking chances about misidentification. I'm looking down the corridor now. I see another demonstrator being picked up off the floor. He also has gone limp. The policemen are trying to lift him up. He slips out from under their arms. They're twisting. One arm is back in a hammerlock. The other arm is bent underneath him. And there, the third policeman has lifted his legs up, and he's been carried face down into the elevator and has been placed on the ground. He's lying on his stomach. I think they're turning him over now. It's hard to see over the crush of people. They're using numbers printed on slips of paper. And the number they're holding up against his chest as they take his photograph is number 7. Another demonstrator is being moved along. This one hasn't gone completely limp, but he's got his coat twisted around him, I guess by his own desire. He seems now in the elevator to have gone limp. Again, there's this struggle to get him set for a picture. He seems to have gone very limp, and he's a fairly tall fellow, so that they're having a hard time. They seem to have got him set now, and there goes the flashbulb. That, according to the count, if that number was accurate, was number 8. Here comes another demonstrator. This one's a young lady. She's gone limp, more or less, but is walking along with them. No, they've carried her. She was lifted off the ground and carried into the elevator. There is a policewoman, Berkeley policewoman, who has also entered the elevator with her. I see they have the policewoman along in case any of the young lady demonstrators run into any trouble. They're holding a number 9 up. picture has been taken again. And a short description or statement, perhaps they're taking some kind of statement or requesting information, is being taken. The elevator is now about to descend. The policewoman has left it.
By 7:15, the fourth floor was cleared, but only about 70 students had been arrested. At this point, the pace was accelerated. The highway patrolmen and deputy sheriffs were pressed into service, and the students who had until then been transported to the basement in the elevator were now taken forcibly down the stairs. At about the same time, the police attempted to arrest the leaders of the demonstration. One group of about a dozen policemen made a surprise rush up the main stairs to the second floor, arrested one leader, and took away the microphone of the public address system with which the students had been addressing people outside the building. But there were other leaders and an extra microphone. After that, the students packed in tightly around the window leading to a balcony where the remaining leaders stood to use the PA system. About 8 a.m., police made another rush, this time in greater force.
As I continue to charge the talking people from Alameda County and California Highway Patrol, have moved into the lobby area of the second floor. Some 30 patrolmen, and the students continue to sit in the floor. California patrolmen are moving in, led by an inspector of plain clothes. Over the heads of the students who are sitting down and moving very swiftly, pushing their way up over the seated demonstrators, stepping on them and kicking them. These are men of the California Highway Patrol and Alameda Coast.
And you've been listening to a rather scratchy recording of an old record, which was produced by KPFA, a radio station in Berkeley, back in 1964. It actually sounds a lot better when you hear the record. I guess the recording mechanism leaves something to be desired. You're tuned to the freakradio.org, which is the stream of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Phone lines are still open, 427-3772. Free speech movement was a movement to allow, it protested the shutdown of the rights of students to organize on campus, which was a sudden ban was put on all off-campus activity, organized even, you know, ordinary political activity around political candidates was criminalized, or at least was made a no-no by the UC Berkeley administration. And as I understand it, this was primarily done because of civil rights protests that were being organized, sit-in or protests against racial discrimination action, actions against racial discrimination against influential businesses in Oakland that were having some impact and that really angered the powers that be. The Wikipedia has a bit of a description of the... Well, it's actually too small a description for me to want to read more of it. A month after these arrests, the university brought charges against the students who organized the sit-in, resulting in an even larger student protest that all but shut down the university. After much disturbance, the university officials slowly backed down. By January 3, 1965, about a month after this sit-in that you're hearing, the new acting chancellor, Martin Mayerson, who replaced the resigned Edward Strong, whose voice you heard earlier, established provisional rules for political activity on the Berkeley campus, designating the Sproul Hall steps as an open discussion area during certain hours of the day and permitting tables. This applied to the entire political spectrum, not just the liberal elements that drove the FSM, the free speech movement. Most outsiders identified the free speech movement as a movement of the left. Students and others opposed to U.S. foreign policy did indeed increase their visibility on campus following the FSM's initial victory. In the spring of 1965, the FSM was followed by the Vietnam Day Committee, a major starting point for the anti-Vietnam War movement. And I haven't been up to campus lately. I may be going up to Berkeley later this week to pick up Street Spirit, the monthly newspaper which homeless people sell in order to get coffee money. And I may do a kind of a check on that. I'm always a little wary of getting nostalgic about this stuff, but I get nostalgic anyway sometimes, although I was not a part of this movement. I knew friends. I had friends who were. I was not terribly active politically when I was of high school and college age, which was around, that's what I was around those days. In any case, there are celebrations, or have been celebrations up there for the 50th anniversary of the free speech movement. But the issue, of course, is not looking back and celebrating what went on then, but seeing what's going on now, because we have illegal and expanding wars abroad and very little action against them that I'm aware of. I mean, but rather than talk about that, which needs to be talked about, but really needs to be acted against, I really want to give some time, while I still have it, to the voices of people who I talk to on the streets here and there, around about, who are facing in Santa Cruz this kind of tightening grip, requiring them to move here, move there, restricting their space, making them worry about what they're going to do next, which police officer they're going to offend, which first alarm security guard is going to come up with another requirement. Let's hear some interviews from the street.
Revenue is about 20 to 6 on the 6th of October.
And before we go any further, I'm talking at a man who has got a number of his own original artworks displayed on his own original display device, which is about, 6 feet 3 inches tall, in violation of the ordinances. But this man doesn't seem to carry, has a great black hat on. What's your name, sir?
Oh, I didn't know this was going to be an interview.
Well,
let me tell you about springing that mic on me, brother.
Uh-oh. Well, so you're saying she shouldn't be talking at this time?
I'm in the middle of a drawing. I'm not quite prepared to launch into something, and I don't really want to be associated with the whole, like...
I understand.
Information about
the snitch
this,
who tells on the blue dots.
Making an observation.
And actually, no, the man is working. I'm going to let him get back to his artwork. Thank you, sir, and good luck with it.
No problem.
Recommend people check out his artwork. It's usually just downtown, probably moving every hour or so, or maybe not. We'll see. But it has been pointed out to me that there are now blue dots on the sidewalk.
And the individual I'm talking about, you've often seen downtown, used to be the Art is Free guy. But he has his own sort of very compact but tall stand in which his artwork is displayed. It's interesting artwork. Wouldn't call them portraits, wouldn't call them abstractions, somewhere between the two. Some say surrealistic, but I'm not quite sure what that means.
An uncertain nature. Maybe they plan to excavate the area. I'm looking at blue dots in front of Sway and Verizon Wireless that take up 6x2 square area. Becky Johnson, what do you make of this?
The dots? I think that when they made the downtown ordinances so restrictive that the great Morgani announced he was quitting, and they went and said, oh, gee, I guess we did make it too restrictive. So now they're trying to set out some zones. I think that's what we're seeing the start of, but it's just a guess.
Fair enough. Thank you. In search of the blue dots on Pacific Avenue, we see another artist is here. Perhaps she can give us some... some light. You have red dots around you. What does this mean, artist?
I believe it means I'm supposed to stay within these confines.
And these red dots, which are in front of...
restrictions, in front of shoe fetish.
In front of shoe fetish. That looks like 1, 2, 3. It's a 3x2 area of red dots, which is a total of... let's see, 6 is, that's 12 feet by 6 feet. So that's, you're within a 12 by 6 foot area. I notice that you're stamped.
So again, Julie Handy's email, the city official who apparently is overseeing or at least knowledgeable about these dots on Pacific Avenue that are being marked into the sidewalk, red represents tabling and vending only, whereas blue includes both tabling, vending, and performance, and yellow represents performance only, so you can keep your eyes peeled and come to your own conclusions as you walk along Pacific Avenue.
That is outside the area by at least half a square. How do you stand on this issue?
I'm rebelling.
You are a rebel.
Yes.
What is your name, rebel, for our police records?
Alexandria Papera.
And Alexandria, how goes the art break? Looks like you got some great artwork here.
Going beautifully. I can't complain at all.
How would you describe your work?
It's surreal. It's dreamlike and it's visionary.
A lot of, there's some human figures here, mostly female human figures, it looks like. I don't see any penises here.
A lot of color, yes. A lot of wild animals, wilderness, and beautiful women.
And what do you charge for young women? What about older women? Do you have any older women who are beautiful here?
I think that most of these women are timeless. They're in their youth. They're not even real women, really. I mean, if you can see...
You're not pandering to the youth cult of the, you know, the commercial magazines?
They're ethereal women, yes. They're from another plane of existence. Yeah.
Fair enough. So if one were to want to purchase one of these, take one of these home, how much would it be?
I charge $10 a print, but I ask, I don't ask that strictly. If someone has less than that, then I say, sure, you're donating to my cause. I never want to turn anyone away.
And how have you done today with this?
I think I've done all right. I haven't been here for very long.
Have you been moved along every hour?
No, not yet. No one's bothered me at all. Yeah. Hi there. Yeah.
I hope I'm not driving away your customers. Let me see if I have any... can people see your work online if they're not?
They can, yes. I'm the only Alexandria Papera.
We're moving to slow speed.
I'm the only Alexandria Papera on Facebook. Spell the last. P-E-P.
Papera on Facebook.
Spell the last.
P-E-P-E-R-A.
Well, there you have it.
My public art album is available for anyone to view. You don't even have to be my friend on Facebook to see it. It's called My Paintings.
No hassles?
No hassles today. I've never really had a hassle down here yet. I've been down here for a couple of months.
Come on, Zach. Check out the paintings.
Oh. Mm. Yeah.
Thank you. So, Alexandra, you are... It's Alexandra, yes?
Yes.
You also have a sort of a notorious past as...
I was the lead singer and... brainchild of a band called Unicorn Face, an experimental psychedelic pop band, Asylum Rock.
And was this regularly featured on Free Radio Santa Cruz?
We were on there once, and I think we scared everyone away.
I see. And when do you intend to do a reprise of your good old days?
I don't really work with music anymore. I've just focused on painting now. So I'm a full-time painter. I don't even do anything else, really, at all.
Mm-hmm. In fact, you have... a marker in your hand and a small pad, and are creating another feature, a figure, a form, something.
Yes. This is a three-faced being from some other dimension that I have just started drawing about 20 minutes ago. They're blowing bubble gum together, all three of these.
I see. It has an alien look.
Yeah, I'm very into the unknown.
We've been talking with...
Alexandria Papera.
Thanks, Alexandria. I'm in front of the Surf Life near the Santa Cruz Coffee Roasting Company. And again, we see more red dots, again, containing an area of 6 of the 2x2 squares, which an artist here we spoke to earlier suggests is perhaps indicating they only want one artist in this spot. Although, legally speaking, And we have another artist up here inside a series of blue dots.
Everybody,
let's listen to this man.
I sang kill, but just want to catch you away.
SoundCloud. My username is Brennan C B R R R R R E N N A N. So it's B. It's Brennan with five R's and then the letter C.
Spell Brennan.
The way it is on my SoundCloud or in real life?
In for people to find you online.
On my SoundCloud, it's B R R R R R E N N A N.
Thank you, Brennan.
You.
Can you want to do it anonymously, or you want to say who you are? We're at the Red Church here.
Oh, I'll say who I am.
What's your name?
My name is Leah.
And Leah, you're a resident of El Centro?
Yeah, we call it Hell's Centro.
Hell's Centro. And you do that because?
Because they've made it a living hell living there. It's like being in jail. They write you up for the littlest things. They say you're breaking the rules.
Give us an example.
You walk down the hall and you have your socks on, not your shoes, and they go, oh, you have to have your shoes on. We're going to write you up.
What's significant?
You say the word bullshit. That's not the way it's supposed to be. And they write you up for profanity. They write you up. It's like jail. And what does it mean? Who knows what it means? They write you up.
So how many times have you been written up?
Oh, more than I can count.
And?
Because I don't take their crap.
How long have you lived there?
It's 10 months now, and I'm moving out November 30th.
What is the rent?
Well, the rent is based on income or if you have Section 8 HUD.
Uh-huh.
And I pay about $450 a month. I'm very low income, Social Security. I'm 67 years old. And
don't look it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
But anyway, I've rented a house or apartment my whole life, brought up my son as a single mom, and I have never lived like this before in my life. I've never not paid my rent until I got old and I got sick. And
medical expenses did you in?
Not really medical expenses, but just the fatigue. And I didn't have any medical insurance. I've never worked a job my entire life where I had any benefits, and I mostly worked for myself.
What kind of work did you do?
I've done insurance, investments. I've had my security license, my insurance license. For 17 years, I did massage therapy and hypnotherapy in Palo Alto, where I raised my son. And then different various jobs, in-home care. I was a waitress in college, you know, the usual. Answering service, telemarketing.
Are there others in the El Centro who feel as you do that might stand together with you to file appropriate grievances with the federal agencies involved or with other city authorities?
The thing is, most of the people there are long-time homeless. They maybe were on the street for 10 years. They're all scared of losing their housing again. And I was, too. I didn't want to be homeless before I moved here. There were a couple of nights I had to sleep in my car. It's hard to find housing when you're an old lady in this town. The young people don't want to live with you, even though I was making, you know, basically enough money to pay the rent. But, I'd say about a third of the people are longtime addicts, drug addicts, and another third are alcoholics, 30-year alcoholics, and then we have over 40% of the population, I've estimated, on antipsychotic drugs. So
that makes 100%.
Kind of.
But you are one of those categories? Or?
No, I'm not. And I had no idea that when you applied for low-income housing that you can wind up in a place like that. It's a loony bin. And they're telling you what to do all the time. They come in my kitchen. They come in my room. They come down my hallway. They tell me where I can go, who I can visit, who I can talk to, what to do in my own kitchen. And I tell them...
Get lost?
Yeah. Get the hell out. This is my house.
And who are the officials who do this?
The managers. We've had various managers. It took us 5 months to get rid of the one who was there when I moved in. Her name is Sherry Kaysen.
And what procedure did you use to get rid of her, and why did you feel it was necessary to do that?
Well, people did get together, and everybody reported every single thing of elder abuse that she did. Every verbal abuse, every criticism, every insult, every humiliation, everything.
And give me an example. Did you yourself suffer this as well?
Yeah.
Give me an example.
Even before I moved in, I went to senior legal services about her because I thought something was going on. I couldn't figure out what was going on. Was this reverse discrimination? Because she's black and I'm white? What is she doing?
What did she do that caused you to go to senior legal service?
You know, it was... little things, but over and over and over again. Like she said, oh, you made a mistake on this form, and you can't cross out. I said, oh, well, you told me to cross it out last time. No, I didn't. Or, there's a discrepancy in the address that you gave when you first applied and the address you're giving now. And I said, Sherry, I've been moving like every 2 or 3 months for the last 4 years. I don't remember.